le venimos a contar que seguimos de pie, que la muerte y el miedo no nos paralizan y que vamos a continuar el legado de Berta Cáceres.
Son 5 meses desde que nos robaron los brazos de nuestra madre, 5 meses desde los que la tierra habla y se sigue proclamando para llamar a la justicia. No solo por ella, sino por todos los defensores y defensoras de la vida que en nuestro país están siendo asesinados. Son 5 meses desde los que seguimos llamando para denunciar las políticas militaristas, asesinas que se implementan en nuestro país y de la que también participan las empresas transnacionales, el modelo extractivo asesino, las hidroeléctricas, la minería, los proyectos de venta de oxígeno.
Escuchamos, también hubo pronunciamientos en contra del golpe de Estado en Brasil. De este modo, despedimos este Contacto Sur, invitándoles a seguir esta cobertura especial y a seguir en sintonía. Les habló María Cianci Bastidas desde Montreal, Canadá.
Tras conocerse que el Servicio Federal de Seguridad de Rusia ha frustrado una serie de atentados en Crimea, el presidente ruso Vladimir Putin ha asegurado que Ucrania, en lugar de buscar una solución pacífica, ha pasado a practicar el terror. Yelena Milinchik tiene más detalles.
El Servicio Federal de Seguridad ruso ha impedido varios ataques en la península de Crimea. Según su información, estos atentados estaban organizados, planeados por la inteligencia del Ministerio de Defensa ucraniano. También sabemos que los objetivos de estos ataques han sido, en primer lugar, la infraestructura y también diferentes objetos de apoyo que son de una importancia vital para la península. También el presidente ruso Vladimir Putin ha declarado que en esta operación han muerto 2 militares rusos y que el país no lo pasará por alto. También dijo que este intento de atentado por la parte ucraniana ha sido un paso bastante estúpido, y que se hizo para desviar la atención de los problemas internos ucranianos. También mencionó que en una situación así sería bastante absurdo organizar un encuentro en el formato de cuarteto de Normandía que estaba planeado para la cumbre de G20 en China. Vamos a escuchar las palabras del presidente ruso.
Por lo visto, las personas que se alzaron con el poder en Kiev y siguen reteniéndolo, en vez de buscar los compromisos sobre los cuales estuvimos hablando en el contexto de la salida del conflicto de Nagorno-Karabaj, han pasado a la práctica del terror en vez de buscar unos métodos de solución pacífica.
El Servicio Federal de Seguridad ruso también ha declarado que durante esta operación se ha descubierto toda una red de agentes rusos y también durante esta operación ha sido detenido al menos uno de los organizadores de estos ataques y también varias personas de nacionalidad, tanto rusa como ucraniana, que ayudaban a planear estos ataques. También sabemos que en el sitio de detenciones, que es la ciudad de Armiansk, en la península de Crimea, como ya hemos dicho, se han encontrado alrededor de 20 artefactos explosivos compuestos por algo más de 40 kilos de nitrilita, también diferentes municiones y granadas. Se informa que en estos momentos, en esta localidad y también en toda la península de Crimea, la situación está bastante tranquila y eso es importante porque es un sitio muy importante turístico para Rusia. También tenemos la información del Ministerio de Defensa ucraniano, la información del portavoz del Estado Mayor ucraniano. Ellos en primer lugar han desmentido esta información y también han dicho que este tipo de información tiene un carácter de provocación.
Finalmente escucharemos una entrevista con Adán Benito Mejía, padre de Adán Mejía López, un preso político. Durante su plática con Norma Martínez, habla de la cultura indígena, de la forma arbitraria usada para enviar a su hijo Adán a la cárcel y sobre la necesidad de hablar con la verdad para lograr cambios sustanciales en México. Escuchemos.
Está preso porque en junio del 2014 nos sentamos aquí en el Zócalo, en el plantón que actualmente está, ha tenido levantamientos, quiere decir que nos vamos por un tiempo y regresamos, según las asambleas, lo decide las asambleas generales del magisterio. Nosotros somos artesanos. Adán sabe hacer bolsas de palma y de plástico, sabe tallar la piedra, sabe tallar la madera, sabe fundir, sabe soldar, sabe hacer escultura, sabe muchas cosas Adán, pero se quedó trunca su carrera en sociología. Entonces nosotros somos de la Mixteca, del distrito de Coyzahuaca, donde había los mejores tejedores del arte plumario, los amantecas que les decían en náhuatl, y de los que labraban el oro en hilos, tejían el oro y la plata y soldaban. Todo el arte que encontró el maestro Caso, arqueólogo, en la tumba 7 de Monte Albán, son orfebres de Coyzahuaca. De allí somos nosotros, de la raza chicholteco-mixteca. Somos los que, desde el imperio nahuatlaco, nos oponíamos a que pasaran sobre nuestro territorio, porque también, si nos conquistaban, exigían un impuesto en especie, en plumas, en oro, en granos, y nos opusimos. Ahí todavía en la sierra de Tepelmeme, en la sierra de Tiopan, en la sierra de Concepción, que eran de Huitlán originalmente, allí están las torres que eran especie de vigias, desde donde se puede ver todavía en esta actualidad, a una distancia considerable, quién viene o quién va por esos parajes.
¿Cómo fue la elección? Tengo entendido que él estaba organizando a los vendedores aquí.
Él era parte de la coordinación de los vendedores de aquí, de los artesanos de aquí del Zócalo.
¿Por qué no pueden vender libremente aquí en el Zócalo?
No, porque los dueños de los portales que están a su lado izquierdo y a su lado derecho, ellos se consideran dueños absolutos del Zócalo y de los espacios alrededor. Entonces ellos hablan de una falsa limpieza, de un falso orden, de unos falsos principios jurídicos. ¿Por qué? Porque se dice que el territorio de Oaxaca, que es donde hay más naciones indígenas, nosotros somos los dueños originarios y tenemos derecho, como se hacía antes de que llegaran los europeos, a truecar o a comerciar nuestros productos, que es que no son monedas, pues sino son el cacao, tenía el algodón, otra como moneda, pero jamás eran metálicos. Y eso se sigue conservando hasta la actualidad. Si usted va al mercado de Tlaxiaco, al de Ocotlán, que está para acá, rumbo a...
¿Todavía hay intercambio?
Todavía hay intercambio, en pequeño, pero lo hay.
¿Cómo lo que se quiere hacer el día de hoy?
¿No? Como lo que se quiere hacer el día de hoy, que era el verdadero comercio en la época primitiva, ¿no? O sea, cuando no habían surgido los metales como moneda de cambio.
Sí.
Entonces, todo eso se conserva aquí. Aquí nosotros tenemos parajes actualmente... para que no nos perdamos, mi hijo entró porque se le acusó de balear a un porro de cue que se llama Vicente Almanza, que es el porro mayor del Aguajo. Si usted va y pregunta al Aguajo, quien, sobre todo en la Facultad de Derecho, quién es el porro mayor, que es gente de Vicente Cue Monteagudo, es Vicente Almanza. Él vino, por orden de él, vino a balearnos aquí en el Zócalo cuando estábamos intercambiando nuestros productos artesanales y frutas, granos. Fue en el 2014. Entonces Adán levantó un acta, nada más que el Ministerio Público la archivó, y por orden de Cue también Almanza levantó un acta, y esa fue la que siguieron promoviendo. La de Adán la archivaron. El otro delito es que lo acusan de que cuando lo detuvieron, él le pegó a los policías que lo detuvieron, si eran más de 15 y con armas de largo alcance. Eso no pudo hacer. Pretestan que los mordió y quién sabe, y que les jaloneó y los rasguñó, y eso no es cierto. Mi hijo dijo, pues aquí estoy, ¿qué es lo que quieren? Más jamás los agredió ni nada.
¿Lo arrestaron en su casa o fue en la calle?
Fue aquí en la calle Hidalgo y 20 de noviembre, donde está la farmacia del ahorro. Allí.
¿Ya lo procesaron o todavía sigue esperando?
No, déjeme decirle de los otros delitos. Luego, el tercer delito, lo acusan de que fue el autor intelectual de bajar las cámaras C4. Las cámaras C4 se acordó bajarlas en una asamblea estatal del magisterio. Como usted verá, mi hijo no fue el de esa iniciativa. Y otro de robo a un comercio, tampoco mi hijo no estuvo en eso. Entonces, y de las cámaras igual, no estuvo allí porque estaba en una comisión aquí fuera de la ciudad de Oaxaca, entonces no estuvo en la bajada de las cámaras. En síntesis, son delitos prefabricados, todos, como le prefabricaron al compañero Rubén, al compañero Otón, a los maestros, pues todos son delitos prefabricados, o sea, o montados, como se dice. Estos delitos, el gobierno de Cue no ha podido demostrar nada, no ha llegado pruebas a los tribunales. Y son tan cínicos y tan violadores de las leyes que dicen respetar, que cuando se vio que mi hijo alcanzaba el amparo en el primer delito, la jueza le dijo del quinto distrito que no lo soltaba porque era un peligro para la sociedad y que lo podrían matar si lo soltaba. Entonces, como usted verá, dicen mentiras, dicen cosas engañadas, dicen cosas fuera de las normas jurídicas que ellos dicen hacer respetar. Y hasta el día de hoy están por cerrarse las instrucciones. No sabemos si lo van a condenar o porque está también dentro de los 40 de presos políticos de Mexiterio que se exige su libertad, ¿verdad? Porque no se ha logrado demostrar los delitos de que los acusan. Entonces, pues mi hijo es un ciudadano que siempre se ha comportado como un luchador social. ¿Un luchador social cómo se comporta? Se comporta exigiendo que al pueblo le resuelvan sus problemas. A los niños les den educación, a los jóvenes les abran las universidades, a los campesinos les den créditos blandos para trabajar la tierra, porque actualmente en Oaxaca principalmente la tierra no se trabaja porque los créditos que dan los bancos y ni los dan son onerosos, y el gobierno los da pero partidistamente, o sea, da créditos aquí cuando se acercan las elecciones y te dice: entrégame tu credencial de elector y te doy tanto de fertilizante, tanto de semilla. O sea, todo lo manejan aquí los gobiernos, tanto priistas, parredistas y panistas, los manejan partidistamente. Mi hijo se opone a todo eso, ¿verdad? Nosotros queremos que si no, los dineros son de la nación, se le den a los campesinos, a los estudiantes, a los obreros que lo necesitan, ¿verdad? Sin que nos exijan un partidismo político. Entonces, nosotros pues somos indígenas. Yo soy indígena chocholteco mixteco, mi hijo es indígena chocholteco. Yo soy un guerrero porque en la mixteca todos nos decimos guerreros por autonomacia, porque creemos en los principios que vienen de hace miles de años, defender nuestra tierra, donde decimos quererla hasta la muerte y si es necesario morir por ella.
¿Dónde puede la gente encontrar más información sobre el caso de Salud?
En una página de correo electrónico que es Tequio Mixteco. Invito no solamente a los oaxaqueños, sino al pueblo de México, sobre todo a la clase trabajadora, ya sea del campo, de la ciudad, ya sea en la fábrica, en la oficina, con los medios de comunicación como usted, a que digamos la verdad, a que desenmascaremos a los gobiernos de este país, a los partidos de este país y principalmente al presidente, que está en el poder, que es el espurio Peña Nieto, porque todos sabemos que se robó la presidencia.
Así concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de todas las personas que hicieron posible este programa, el mismo que es producido gracias a las generosas donaciones de las y los radioyentes. A nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide de tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, which is what you're tuned to, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Bathrobe Spears Broadsize, the August 11th, 2016 show, with a special report from the Coastal Commission and a victory around the RV ban. And I'll be talking about that and maybe playing some audio from that, so stay tuned. In fact, because of some technical difficulties in the studio, I'm going to have to begin with interviews without our customary theme song. Sing me a song of social significance. So you're going to have to sing your own songs out there, make your own social significance, which actually is probably a lot better. So let's look at something of social significance from, I guess it's almost a week ago. Let's take a look for sure here. I ran into Curtis Relaford on the streets. For those of you who are regular listeners, you may remember that Curtis is an African-American activist who's got some mighty big trucks, which he often dances on top of in order to celebrate peace, love, and fundraising for different causes, particularly concerned recently with the shootings of African-Americans in other cities by police, murders, you might say, as well as the what seems like retaliatory behavior in Baton Rouge. And this is a little out of date now, but it's not really out of date because it's happening. Anyway, I ran into him, and he has he's been experiencing problems on Pacific Avenue, threats from police. Apparently that has been a little bit resolved, or at least it isn't heavily in evidence in the last couple of weeks. At least this is what his account is. But he has some other stories that are not encouraging, that smack of racism, police abuse, and, well, those two things certainly. Let's listen in. Here in front of the Curtis Relaford Peace vehicle parade, actually it's a vehicle and pulling another vehicle, and Curtis, as ever, is in his gray business suit. It's a little snazzier than a business suit, and he's arranging signs, "Thou shalt not kill," "We face a moral crisis," and so forth. So, Curtis, pause now and give me a break. Apparently, Curtis is doing some busy stuff here, so it's may not be happening. He's taking down a, I don't know, 10-foot-long series of signs.
I just thank you.
So, Curtis, should I wait, or are you going to be doing? You're going to be doing other stuff. What's the story here?
I'm late. I'm running down here to the elevator.
All right. So while you're moving, let me ask you. Last time we met, you and I did some dancing on top of your van, and you were concerned about police harassment. Has any of that happened since?
No.
And the answer is no, and that's a good answer. That's all I need. Just one. Well, good luck to you, man.
He came around 10 o'clock in the morning and told me I couldn't sit there all day.
And what's happening now is, after a brief break, and Curtis was sort of on the move and trying to get prepared to get out, he had a whole bunch of large signs he had placed around his vehicle, which was parked in front of what we call the Rittenhouse Mausoleum, which is across from Verizon on Pacific Avenue, down near Urban Outfitters. I think there are still an Urban Outfitters down there. And he's now talking about something that happened to him a couple of weeks ago, which sounds pretty grim.
I remember that I was talking.
The wind is...
He told me I couldn't sit there all day. But somebody had called and complained. I was down there in front of Starbucks. But he came and told me that. And I turned the music down. And he didn't come back, and I didn't leave either. I didn't. I say, no, I'm paying the meter. They ain't taking up a two spots. Them folks down the way, they selling stuff, and they've been there all day. And they had taken up two spots. It's just in two cars. Mm-hmm. So I'm feeling, Rob, like I'm being singled out by always being talked to about I'm doing the wrong thing.
And again, to clarify, this incident which he's relating, happened earlier in the last few days on Pacific Avenue, as I understand it. But he will soon go into another incident that was a little more extreme, and that happened a bit down south. I think he said it was Aptos.
And I look, and then when I go plain clothes, I ain't in the monkey suit,
right.
And I ain't in my overalls, and I just walk down to observe. Man, there are folks doing the same thing I'm doing, even louder and continuously, in front of the same shops that's giving me hell. So I'm thinking, Joe's Pizza got a little racism going. That ice cream parlor across from the Del Mar Theater got a little bit of racism going. Definitely Java Junction got a little racism going, big time, because we had a whole knockdown drag out and we left there. And then the other one is the Highway Patrol. We out there with the peace, the ladies who wear all black with the peace vigil.
And before I get into the peace vigil incident involving the Highway Patrol, I'd like any listeners who may be aware of problems or seen instances of discrimination against African Americans, either at the Java Junction, the ice cream parlor that is across from the Del Mar Theater, and also the Joe's Pizza, which is across from New Leaf Market. What I'm talking about may not even be seen as a form of racism against well-to-do African-American customers, but has to do with merchants complaining about his van and his music, which he claims, Curtis claims, was softer than, or at least not really louder than, other things that were being played on the street. This is, of course, a similar claim made, ironically, by a very homophobic preacher who's now suing the city. And I've talked about, his name is Harmon. He's a guy from Pleasanton who was repeatedly harassed, it seems like, from his legal proceedings, which I read at some length. I think it was either last show or the show before that. So I'm curious to know if this kind of stuff is happening. I'm pretty sure it's happening with respect to the police department toward Curtis. And the police will, of course, tell you with a straight face that they're simply carrying out the instructions of or complaints from merchants. But really, the police have a certain obligation, not just simply to be a goon squad for this person or that, particularly not necessarily for the merchants who are notorious for wanting to clear away non-commercial activity from Pacific Avenue, but they also have a responsibility to see if an actual law is being violated. So the law in question here would be unreasonably disturbing noise or amplified sound and requiring a permit. And Curtis has complained to me in the past that he got permits and they ignored the fact that he had them, insisting he was still too loud. And that there is in the Santa Cruz ordinance a particular problem, or at least a reality, that there's no decibel level which is clarified so that you can say, well, if you're lower than the decibel level, you're okay. If you're higher, you're in violation of the ordinance. Instead, it is a very subjective standard. And I myself am aware of this ordinance because I've been prosecuted under it, successfully prosecuted, even though I wasn't in any way louder than others on the street. It's just the individuals in question didn't like what I was doing. The guy upstairs during midday claimed we interfered with his sleep with our singing of Downtown with Homeless Lyrics in front of the bookshop Santa Cruz. In any case, let's hear some more from Curtis, who gets into a somewhat more serious account of how he was treated by the Highway Patrol, which we're going to hear now.
We go out there, me and a Native American man go out there to sit with them on a Sunday. Quiet, not saying nothing, just holding our sign. Rob, do you know one cop car came up, and these young guys, they couldn't even get out the car because the curb had them, and if I had a gun, I could have shot them. They couldn't even get out the car. When they did get out the car, they approached me. This is not even my gathering. Me and the Native American man telling us that we can't do that. We are obstructing the traffic. And the traffic didn't get obstructed until they came.
Now, where was this?
On Rio Del Mar exit.
And these were the highway patrols.
Highway patrol. Then those, then I got kind of, I was nice.
Mm-hmm.
I was nice. And then they just came on with all of this interrogation. And that's when I went off. I said, man, look inside yourself. Look what the signs say, man. What do your heart say? You talk about the rules and the regulations, but the things say peace. You a peace officer? Don't that go together?
And they said,
we need to move. And had his hand on the gun. So now it's been flipped over to Tito, the Native American young kid, then flipped over to him, asking the cop, can he take this hand off the gun? You're making me nervous. We'll take your hand off the gun when you leave.
Really?
So that's where, that's what happened.
Any names of these cops, did you notice?
Yeah, I got them.
You're checking in your pocket to see.
And this sort of is a key thing. I think it's really important to get the names of the police officers who do this, to complain about them, even though the police department will probably do absolutely nothing about it, but to begin the record of what police officers are doing what. And so the police officers will learn, either through seeing themselves on YouTube or reading about themselves in the local paper when you write a letter about them, that their behavior, however high-handed they think they can be, is not going unnoticed and undocumented and uncriticized. It's a slow process. It's not a revolution by any means. But it sets the stage for broader movements when people will understand, as they are now doing across the United States with the Black Moves, across the world actually, with the Black Lives Matter movement, that there is a real extreme situation that has been essentially overlooked and accepted for decades, if not centuries, regarding police departments, particularly in Western countries around African Americans, where police departments evolved out of slave catchers to a large extent, and in other respects are simply class guards for the property of the well-to-do, and becomes in Santa Cruz the standards of the well-to-do.
What did I do with him now?
Checking your memo book here.
Wait a minute. Oh, it's on a little piece of paper. Oh, no, Rob. I think I tore it out trying to give the lady their name, because we're writing a letter. We're writing a letter to the police department.
Good.
Hey. And we're writing a letter to the newspaper. Hey, Beth, how you doing?
Good. How you doing?
I feel good. Fantastic. Great. Out of sight. Enjoying every minute of my life.
You're ahead of me, man.
All right, Beth. All right.
So, you know, when you get them, if you want to give me a call, I'll post them. You know, I'll mention that you're, and I'll talk about them on free radio.
Okay.
We're going to be playing this on free radio tomorrow, I'm expecting.
Okay. Cause,
and how long ago was this? What day was this?
That was 2 weeks ago.
Okay. And
2 weeks ago on a Sunday.
And so you eventually moved, or you...
Yeah, we left. We had to, because I was getting to...
Turning into a, just, I got my gun with you.
Yeah,
take a look at some point if you're interested. Let me know. You have my number.
Okay. Hey, thank you. Thank you.
And I appreciate you taking time. I hope you're not too late for your next event.
No. Okay.
Event.
You just reminded me. See, you get me going, Rob.
All right, man.
Thank you.
Thank you. Curtis Relaford. And that music you hear is his music coming from his van, which is not terribly loud. Here in front of the...
Yeah, it looks like we're getting some of the equipment working again. I want to remind you, as you're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, freakradio.org, that this is a call-in show. And the call-in number here is 831-427-3772. Again, grab a pencil if you're at home, or, I don't know, focus on what I'm saying if you're not, 831-427-3772, and you can be a part of this discussion. The most recent event, and one that I've gotten the most input from in the last 24 hours, has been the success of, the unexpected success of an appeal to the Coastal Commission, which happened yesterday, around the issue of Santa Cruz's ill-fated and prejudiced attempt to criminalize RVs all over the city between the hours of midnight and 5 in the morning. They would have preferred to do it throughout the entire day and night, at least those who are pushing for this. And they actually presented an earlier proposal to make it from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m., but they came back with this more limited proposal, which everyone and his mother, myself included, was predicting that we would fail to challenge successfully. But as fate would have it, very surprisingly, we were successful. And we're going to get into that in just a minute. I'm also inviting those who are listening to this broadcast, and there may be more than usual because of this unusually successful situation that happened yesterday at the Coastal Commission, to give a call in with your thoughts, 831-427-3772, and to try to discuss what the next step is going to be. Because while it's true that the city has been stalled, if not stopped, in its attempt to ban parking RVs citywide without a permit, permits not to be allowed except to residents and renters, residents being defined as those who own property or rent here, it's excluding homeless people or visitors passing through in their vehicles. What do we do to deal with issues like the fact that it's illegal to sleep in your vehicle, and there's no legal places to sleep? And this is an old question. It's an endless one, and one that, you know, actually acquired some heat this spring with the as Freedom Sleepers and other groups allied to support former Mayor Don Lane and outgoing council member Don Lane's proposal to remove the word sleeping and, I think, eventually the word blankets from the camping ordinance, which would have it would have removed an obvious human rights violation that the city is preferring to keep on the books, the city council majority, the city staff, the city attorney, but which is under fire in other cities. And there is this sort of creeping or even sweeping right-wing riptide that is happening, as I like to call it, particularly in Santa Cruz, with the empowerment of groups like the Santa Cruz Neighbors, Take Back Santa Cruz, Chamber of Commerce, Downtown Association, Downtown Neighbors, and the Santa Cruz Police Department, as well as right-wing staffers in the city government like Julie Hendy and Scott Collins. What I'm going to do now is contact Councilmember Micah Posner, who was one of the folks who appreciated this victory and didn't think it was going to happen. Let's see if we can get him on the phone. We got him ringing. We'll see. He's at home. He may not be able to talk long because he has a family.
Hello.
Is this the famous Micah Posner, council member at large?
Oh, right.
I should say, you are on free radio, so watch your tongue, okay?
Okay. It's just a hard time because I was just about to have dinner. Okay. Can we do this for 5 minutes?
Let's do it again. So okay. Do you want to trace for us the history of this RV ban, what idiots thought it up and passed it, and how it passed muster when it, you know, when it finally reached the Coastal Commission? 11 coastal members looked at it, and, you know, some of them said it made them sick.
Good for them.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, at least the idea, the kind of bigotry that was incorporated in it, that they saw in other cities as well as Santa Cruz. But where did this thing come from, and is it likely to reappear in your view?
It came from some people on the west side that didn't like RVs parking around their homes and in their neighborhoods and on West Cliff. And it became sort of a, you know, kind of, I don't think Cape Ecstatic was directly involved, but it was that kind of energy, you know, like, we're tired of it. We don't want these homeless people, you know, in our neighborhoods. And there are allegations of drug dealing and illegal discharges of feces, most of which weren't true. There may have been, you know, up to four or something, but, you know, statistically it was insignificant. Anyway, they pressed hard for council members, and the council pushed the staff hard. There were several meetings where the council demanded that the staff, quote, do something, unquote, about the RV problem, quote, unquote. And the staff came back with recommendations to ban all RVs in the city of Santa Cruz all night long from, like, 8 to 8. And as I remember, you asked me about it, and we talked about whether there someone needed a coastal permit, and then you wrote a letter to the Coastal Commission, which I really appreciate, and determined they did need a coastal permit, even though a lot of other cities hadn't gotten one, but that was just because that was a long time ago before these issues were so important. In LA and San Diego, they did try to get one, and with mixed success. So anyways, Councilor Don Lane and I, so then it came to the council, Councilor Don Lane and I said that we would consider supporting it if the council would direct the staff to locate places where people could sleep in vehicles. And interestingly enough, the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women also weighed in and said that that would be a great thing for homeless women who are, you know, totally way vulnerable. And the council, we lost that vote 5-2. They kept coming back in different reiterations because the Coastal Commission wasn't really happy with it from the beginning, and Don and I kept voting against it every time. I had fun reading this passage from Travels with Charlie by John Steinbeck, where he talks about how welcoming California is because he can sleep in his RV everywhere. Finally the Coastal Commission staff agreed to a compromise where they would allow it only from 12 to 5, and some of the council members were quite angry about that, like Rochelle Maroyan, that they have no business, you know, interfering with our stuff. Okay. I got to wrap up in like 1 or 2 minutes. It passed the council 5-2, and looks like the Coastal Commission saw it for what it was, which is total bigotry and unwarranted attacks on homeless people.
And I know you and I disagree on the role of assistant manager Scott Collins, and perhaps what is Julie Hendy's position in the staff? What does she do?
She works for economic development.
Economic development. I know that this proposal, you know, slid through the bowels of the Public Works and Transportation Commission under the leadership of then-chair Rochelle Naroyan a year ago. And so it wasn't anything new. It was kind of tailored there. But anyway, what is next? What kind of macabre crap is the council likely to be dumping on us around, you know, the criminalization of homeless? Or are they? Do you think they're backing off? Do you have any indications?
I don't know. I'm going to find out in the next few weeks. I'm hopeful they're going to back off. I mean, they've just been given a huge wake-up call that our council is way behind the rest of California when it comes to civil rights. So, you know, I think that may have some effect. But I'm going to find out next week or two.
So I know you have to go. I was intending to talk to you about, you know, a broader sense of what accomplishments you feel you've had in the last, I don't know, couple of years when you've been on, well, the last 4 years you've been on the council.
Yeah, I got to go because I want to go to the city council candidate debate.
Let's see if we can do that next time because, you know, I'm very, very critical of you, but I want you to have a chance to, you know, give us the positive.
Thank you, sir. I'll see you later.
Yeah. Okay.
Bye.
That was Councilmember Posner. I'm sure he's accurate. I mean, he's probably not. Yeah, he knows which way he voted on these issues. It's just, I look at his votes, for example, on the performance pens, which were all bad, or at least in my view bad. Those were the blue boxes on Pacific Avenue. And I'll have to come back to you folks to give you a clearer sense of how this went. I guess, I mean, how this particular RV thing went when he was in the council. But again, you know, Micah gets a lot of critique from me because he's one of the few council members that I actually have much dialogue with. Lane doesn't return my calls. I actually had a conversation with David Terrazas yesterday, another council member, and a bad one, on all these issues, or at least the issues of homeless civil rights and police abuse and the stuff that I'm concerned with. And who knows, maybe we can coax him into the studio. I tried to do the same with Assistant City Manager Scott Collins. That seems less likely. He's always refused to come into the studio, but been very courteous and polite in terms of conversations and kind of returning emails fairly promptly, which some agencies won't do at all in the city. At least that's, for example, what I found when I was trying to determine what the status was of the parking situation on the streets near the homeless lack of services center, the 115 Coral Street complex that has become a sort of a gated prison-like scene with all meals to outsiders cut off, with no walk-in shelter at all, with a very kind of highly monitored situation as you approach there, and highly regulated, and sort of a thuggish qualities to the guards who are you have to pass through to get in there. At least these are the accounts. I haven't been there recently. I suppose I should check it out myself, and don't look forward to that, but I probably will at some point. So anyway, you're tuned to Free Radio 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Let's take a brief musical break, and I will be back.
Right or what was wrong? Never taught me to play guitar, never taught me to write songs. One thing that she taught me, I'll remember for all time. Not that you should never walk across a picket line.
I would never walk across a picket line. Solidarity forever, it'll mean just sometimes. Long live the Union, cross my heart and hopes to die. If I should ever walk across a picket line.
Took me to the factory where the workers were on strike. Company has called and staff to break the union's might. Mom went to the front and she addressed those greedy swine. Said, I dare any of you men to walk across the picket line.
Oh, I would never walk across the picket line. Solidarity's forever, don't mean just sometimes. Long live the union, cross my heart and hope to die. If I should ever walk across the picket line.
One of them came forward and he had something to say. No woman will stand between me and one day's pay. I don't care about the others, I am taking what is mine. That we tried to walk across our union's picket line.
Oh, I would never walk across the picket line. Solidarity forever, don't mean just sometimes. I should ever walk across the picket line.
Mom called him a dirty scab and gave him two pieces of her mind. She picked up and she threw every rock that she could find. And when he called the cops on her, she kicked his behind and said, that's what you get when you walk across a union's picket line.
Oh, I would never walk across the picket line. Solidarity's forever, don't mean just sometimes. I should ever walk across the picket line.
Fiddle! I can still remember what my mother used to say.
We're fighting for a better world, not just for better pay.
And if we stick together, then we'll win this fight in time.
As long as we don't walk across each other's picket lines.
Everybody!
I would never walk across a picket line. Solidarity
Sound, that was Evan Greer, a Picket Line song. You can find it online on YouTube. Check it out. And you're still tuned to 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. Call-in number is still 831-427-3772. And since we began to talk about our, yeah, it was a we, me and Micah began to talk very briefly, too briefly, actually, about the RV bigotry brigade and how it was ignominiously blocked by the Coastal Commission, or I should say magnificently blocked, but it was an ignominious proposal. I'm going to read you a little bit from what I wrote online and sent out on the Huff website. Huff is an organization called Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. You can actually get involved with it if you go to the Huff website, huffsantacruz.org. In the past, we've held our meetings every Wednesday at the Sub Rosa Cafe at 11 o'clock. With the low summer turnout, we may be doing some skipping and, I don't know, may have to change that schedule. So the organization still exists. In fact, I felt encouraged, not so much by the Coastal Commission's decision, although that was a high, of course, and I've been getting more praise in the last 24 hours than I've gotten in the last 24 months. That's probably an exaggeration. But people who are encouraged may be willing to do things that have to be done at the local level to make changes and to get people together to unite in coalitions of renters, students, workers, minorities of different kinds, disabled folks, homeless folks, to restore an established civil rights and liberties and services that we need to have here that we don't. And that it's really not enough to be a lone voice in the wilderness to do that, although that's really been the kind of the role I've taken for decades and probably will continue to take because I don't see, you know, this kind of organization coming together. But there seems to be more hopeful signs than in the past. It's kind of, you know, to me it's always ironic and a kind of depressing that people need to get encouragement from individuals on a statewide authority body, you know, the Coastal Commission. People are always seem more willing if they can, you know, get support from one of these power groups that they will then take more action. In fact, the individual we just talked to, Micah Posner, declined to come to the Coastal Commission to speak about it or to be supportive because he thought it was a failure. It couldn't happen. And, you know, most of us, myself included, agreed that it was the staff had already reported, the coastal staff had already accepted sort of a deal with the city council staff that the law would be upheld and there was no real, what they call, no substantial issue. I'm going to read about this now, and if anyone wants to comment on it, do call in 427-3772, area code 831. Coastal Commission yesterday found by an 11-1 vote that the city's midnight to 5 p.m. RV ban involved a, quote, substantial issue and so would require a new hearing in the months to come. Unimpressed with Assistant City Manager Scott Collins' flimsy, if not false, claims that Santa Cruz provides RV alternatives, is dealing with an RV crime crisis, and is only duplicating what other cities have done with their ban. And the significance of this is that a new hearing really means that it's going to be closely considered along the lines of the comments that were made at this hearing, which were quite striking. I mean, they sounded like the kind of stuff I might write or have written about homeless civil rights and homeless issues. And I was also a little cynical about it later as I spoke to friends about this and said, you know, these great liberals on the Coastal Commission are very happy to uphold something that doesn't impact their backyard, but I wonder how they would do if, you know, if RVs and other homeless folks in their own backyard demanded the civil rights that they're all entitled to. They might do just fine, so I don't know. In fact, you know, it's a little prematurely gloomy of me to make predictions around that. But I'd kind of hope that maybe people who know the people on the Coastal Commission can give me some sense of how they generally vote on these kinds of issues. And maybe we can get some more understanding of that. And the call-in number again is 831-427-3772. Don't be shy. And I'm keeping an eye. Well, actually, yeah, I'm keeping an eye on the ringer, or at least I started to. And we have a ringer that rings. I'm keeping an ear on the ringer and an eye on the blinker. So here's what I wrote. Breaking through the bullshit. City Council folks and staffers can bullshit themselves, but it's harder to bullshit the Coastal Commission. In Santa Cruz, staff word is usually holy writ. That's the City Council staff. So they can spin whatever yarns they want with challenge only from the occasional critic that the Santa Cruz City Council then ignores. The Coastal Commission staff, however, they initially advised the City Council, the Santa Cruz City Council staff, that last year's proposed 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. RV ban would be too sweeping to pass muster once I'd filed an appeal. The Coastal Commission staff, after months of consulting with the Scott Collins City Council staff, agreed to a compromise midnight to 5 a.m. ban, swallowing whole Scott Collins' specious arguments. The Coastal Commission staff then recommended upholding the RV's get-out law and denying my appeal. They recommended this to the Coastal Commission, their 12-member, maybe 13-member, anyway, a lot of member Coastal Commission. And usually I was told by the staff, and that's, of course, a dubious source, perhaps, that the staff's recommendations are almost always followed by the Coastal Commission. And since I saw this was not the case, it turned out, in the RV ban situation, it was also not the case in an earlier issue. It made me wonder if, in fact, there's the same problem with the Coastal Commission staff as with the City Council staff. It is entrenched. It is more conservative. It has its own agenda. It also tends to work more closely, perhaps, with developers and bureaucrats and politicians whose objectives are not necessarily the protection of public access to the coasts. Continuing with this story, though they had plenty of time to research, both staffs failed to include the particulars. For instance, that there's a lack of availability of RV parking in Santa Cruz, or there's a minuscule number of churches that actually allow an RV to park, where they actually have to compete with other vehicles, and you can only do 3 vehicles per church. And though there are many churches in Santa Cruz, less than a dozen, as far as I know, allow vehicles to park there. And indeed, the program that the churches that Steve Plaich has been touting for 4 years, actually, the Association of Faith Communities, about how it's always going to be expanding, it expanded to 20 and then it stopped. So it serves 20 people per night, provided you don't want to go out to the Freedom Sleepers and sleep out there one night, because if you do more than one night, you will be thrown out of the program, according to Lucero Luna, one of the activists, and another activist, Sherry Cherie. In any case, it's there. They didn't list the places where people could sleep or even just park their RVs at night during that time that they wanted to remove access, not just to the coastal areas, but to the entire city. And here's perhaps a little clarification. Some have said, if you look at the Sentinel, they have a lot of angry comments by those who feel the Coastal Commission is sticking its nose in, you know, the wrong business here, because they say the Coastal Commission should only be considering the coastal area, and that doesn't include all of Santa Cruz. It only includes a part of it. I was unable to find a coastal map, by the way. I kept trying, and the Coastal Commission staff member, Rosie, promised to send me a map and never reached my email box. She was insistent that she had sent it to me yesterday when I went to the Coastal Commission, but I checked again this afternoon. It wasn't there. So, but the fact is that this RV ban is citywide. It's been held up because if the Coastal Commission does not grant a permit, they are going to have to limit the ban to areas not in the coastal zone. And, of course, what that means is that the higher-priced properties and the beach boardwalk area and Westcliff Drive and so forth is where RVs are going to go park because the rest of the city will be banned. So they're not going to implement this ban until they can get the coastal area as well included. So I appealed this way back in November or so of last year. As I say, I appealed the law and said, don't do it. It may violate the coastal access to the coast for poor people, for low-income people. Even though, you know, it's a limited period of time from midnight to 5. It's still, particularly for people who have to sleep in their vehicles, can't afford the gas money to run their vehicles around, can't afford to pay for other places to go, or who are residents here who have been driven out of their homes by economic conditions or other problems. Rents, of course, are the primary thing I'm thinking of, but I have no stats on that either. And so they need this. They essentially are being denied coastal access. And the Coastal Act, under which the commission operates, does supposedly guarantee the right of everybody access to the coast, generally maximum access. And so I gave this speech, which I'm going to break into my Indy Bay story, because here's more or less the speech I gave. It was somewhat shortened, but this is what I said. This law does not meet the public access and recreation requirements of the Coastal Act, this RV ban. The operative phrase in the act that it does not meet is to maximize public recreational opportunities. This law clearly restricts, if not excludes, them for low-income folks who suddenly have no place to park their vans at night. Now, I have to be honest here. The coastal wasn't brought out by Scott Collins, who apparently wasn't following my speech word for word. Vans are not included in this ban. Now, at the current time, it doesn't really matter because all RVs, including, you know, and vans and other cars, they're limited in where they can park by the permit parking nonsense that Cynthia Matthews, our mayor, introduced, 15 years ago or so, which requires you not to park in various parts of the city where there are posted signs that say you can't park between 12 and 5 or 1 and 6 or whatever without a permit. And you can't get a permit if you're a homeless person. And this, of course, is really the kind of key to what they're really trying to do, which is make this an unwelcome area for homeless vehicles and for poor people. This is an attempt to gentrify the area. The alleged problems are parking related to public safety, public nuisance, inappropriate camping, and other issues. This is what the city council staff and the city council claimed is why they had a right to pass this law, and they had a right to somewhat impede access to the coast at night from 12 to 5. However, I pointed out, these have not been clearly identified and substantiated in terms other than anecdotal. In other words, you got these terror stories that different members of the public who live in their homes brought to the city council. And I'm not denying that these people had real experiences, but that doesn't mean that it's generally true for RVs that they're engaged in committing crimes or that there's a problem that justifies such a sweeping law to eliminate parking citywide for all RVs at night, because that's what the council did under pressure from Rochelle Naroyan, council member, and this Take Back Santa Cruz group of heavies. The real crime, I told this the Coastal Commission, motivating this law is the very presence of people in vans, which makes well-to-do residents uncomfortable. The 400 illegal parking citations and 4 instances of illegal dumping, which were the only citations, only evidentiary documents that they presented that there were particular problems that they could identify. And you can't really, they didn't identify what the illegal parking tickets were for, although they claimed they were all for RVs or makeshift RVs, and that wasn't defined. And that was in the year between 2013 and 2014. I point out all these details because what was really missing from the city council's analysis of this whole situation, and which was pointed out by the Coastal Commission, was they don't have the details to justify that there are real crimes, real problems, and real places for people to go if this law were passed. And the reason they don't is because the city council didn't care. And they assumed that everyone else that this would go to wouldn't care either. If only they could, you know, sweet talk and slick talk through Scott Collins and Julie Hendy and other members of the staff. And they were able to sweet talk and get the Coastal Commission staff to agree with them. And that apparently was, you know, they were all ready for the great victory that they would have because they said the Coastal Commission always does what its staff tells it to do unless there's something very unusual. So I went in there thinking, I'm screwed, but I'll do this anyway. I continued to tell, this is more of my speech to them, where's the documented connection with RVs that supposedly they're in terms of crime? Instead, prejudice and suspicion has replaced careful documentation and common sense. It is clear from council debates this fear is what prompted this law. A litany of offenses is falsely and prejudicially charged against the homeless community without clear evidence or statistical documentation from police. And I actually asked the police chief when he was in the room about this, and he said they've never come to us for statistical evidence. They don't even want to bother with it. They believe that, you know, their prejudice, the force of their bigotry, the fact that they can line up residents, well-to-do residents from the west side, that's sufficient to push it through, and who gives a fuck for the homeless, the people who live in their vans. It's really sad. It's really enraging as well. But that seems to be what the situation was. Continuing what I wrote, the city has reduced the proposed law's sweep. It's not no longer from 8 to 8 or 24 hours a day as they originally proposed it, but it's only from midnight to 5 that there'll be banned RVs were this law to be accepted by the Coastal Commission. But the ordinance is citywide and specifically tailored to impact the poorest. If the Coastal Commission finds there is no substantial issue here and subsequently approves the law, and that's what the city wanted, they wanted the Coastal Commission to say no substantial issue, which means that they would grant the permit and that would be that. But once they say there is a substantial issue, that means that the Coastal Commission holds a new hearing somewhere down the road to examine the whole thing again. And that's what they did find. Very uncharacteristic. I don't know if it was uncharacteristically or not, but it certainly was unexpected from my perspective. If the Coastal Commission finds there is no substantial issue here, I said to them, and subsequently approves the law, it would be essentially banning RV parking late at night throughout the entire city. This would certainly limit coastal impact by those in RVs who would have to leave town to park at night. The poor are a part of the public. They, too, have access rights. And again, I want to clarify that this law would not have impacted smaller vehicles and even vans and SUVs, but only vehicles 22 feet longer and I think higher than 6 or 7 feet or something. But still, it would have impacted a significant number of vans, vehicles that people live in. Unlike Santa Barbara, I continued, speaking to the Coastal Commission, there's been no attempt to provide public safe parking places. And permits are not available for the poor. Very few churches and no businesses that I know of actually allow RVs to park in town. To have coastal access for the poor, it is necessary to park at night. I mean, to have coastal access for the poor, it's necessary to park at night. If you neither rent nor own property, there's no process to get a permit. I talked about this before. This specifically and intentionally excludes those outside whose only home is their vehicle. The objective is clear, to remove homeless-owned RVs and do so without appearing to discriminate by applying it to all RVs, unless connected to residents. they don't want to say use the H word. That would be a little too revealing, so they ban it for everybody. It's kind of like what happens downtown with the downtown ordinance. They don't want to say homeless people get the hell out of here. So they just say, okay, we're making 99% of the sidewalk illegal to sit down on. Unless you bring your own chair. At least that used to be the case. I don't even know if that's still the case. If you bring your own chair, it used to be legal to sit even in areas like within 10 feet of a building. Now it's illegal to sit within 14 feet of a building, a kiosk, an intersection, a phone booth, a bench. It leaves about 1% or less of the original sidewalk. Of course, you can always pay some money and sit in a sidewalk cafe. The point is, these laws have to appear to be neutral. And that was why they banned all the RVs. Or they tried to. Because they didn't want to say, well, we're only banning those tacky homeless RVs. They couldn't say that. That isn't going to fly because it's in a way, it's too real. It's what they really want to do. But it's embarrassing. I mean, you know, freedom, equality of opportunity for everyone, no discrimination based on economic status. Of course there's discrimination. That's the point. But nonetheless, that's what they want to get without saying so. That's the fundamental hypocrisy that Santa Cruz like a cancer, has been creeping all over Santa Cruz for the last 3 decades when I've been here. I mean, the fact that we have a law that makes it illegal to sleep after 11 o'clock at night on the books, that the police enforce when they want, giving them that kind of power, is itself just an indication of how outrageous and explicit the human rights violation is. And don't let anybody tell you, oh, they only enforce it on complaint. Oh, it only happens where there's a problem. Oh, there are places for people to go. There are shelters. None of these things are true. There's some truth to each of those things. But in terms of the 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people, there is place for less than 100 to 200 of them. And you can't get into places at night anyway unless you're on long waiting lists. And now the social service agencies are grasping for funding based on this bogus pathway to housing crap, which, while it's good in theory, the idea that you want to provide housing for people rather than simply abusive and temporary shelter, which are pretty wretched, unless you actually are creating the housing and making it broadly available, it's another one of these 10-year plans to end homelessness that really is a way of funding a bunch of people talking to each other and making the city look like it's doing something when it isn't doing anything except using police to drive people out or drive the people into hiding. Continuing with what I said to the Coastal Commission, this gated NIMBY, not in my backyard, policy ignores whether or not those who own them, the RVs, are law-abiding, environmentally conscious, and respectful of their neighbors. It denies their right and that of visitors to have reasonable access to the coast. Asserting a problem, which is what they did with this ordinance, it's a solution to a problem, you know, like the Jewish problem, the homeless problem, the RV problem, is not to substantiate it, and they didn't substantiate it. That is, it ignores whether RVs as a class specifically, or even generally, create these problems to a degree that would require this draconian ban. It's interesting that a member of the Coastal Commission used this fancy word too, draconian, which means very severe. Unlike in other cities, neighborhoods would not have the option to vote on this law, as is the case in Santa Cruz itself, with other vehicle bans. So if they want to set up a so-called permit parking signs along the street, they have to get 66% of the people in that area to sign on to it. In fact, they sent around Officer Ken Deeg of the Santa Cruz Police Department to lobby all the businesses in Fern, Limekiln, and the streets out there near the homeless Coral Streets, near the homeless Lack of Services Center, to set up a 24-hour ban on vehicles unless they had a permit. And I believe they actually passed it. I appealed it, and then they wouldn't tell me where the appeal went. I guess I should call the Coastal Commission again. I don't think that Fern, Limekiln, and Coral Streets are within the coastal zone, but That still remains a mystery to me. I got to figure out what the coastal zone is. So, but that's generally true. So, but this RV ban, people would have no chance to vote on it, either as a group or as individual neighborhoods. It would just suddenly become swooping down out of Rochelle Noroyan's, I would say out of her ass, because I think that really accurately describes both the carelessness with which it was created and the stench that it really has in terms of its implications around human rights for poor people and basic decency for poor people. She just, I think Rochelle is really clueless on this issue. And I said hello to her at the council commission, coastal commission hearing. You know, she was there, and so was David Terrazas and Scott Collins and Mayor Cynthia Matthews. Though Cynthia did not invite me to tea, as you wouldn't expect. Anyway, I continued my speech. It only took 3 minutes, by the way. I'm spending a lot more time on it than I did at the coastal commission. Nor is the impact considered. If there is no clear documentation of the number of vehicles impacted, how many RVs are impacted, the number of families who live in vehicles impacted, how many people are impacted who live in those vehicles, nor the alternate resources available for parking RVs. Where else can they go? Please name the places, how many can go in a particular place, where they are. None of this stuff was presented either by Scott Collins of the city or by the Coastal Commission staff, which was supposed to be researching these things too, but instead just gave this whole thing a pass and a rubber stamp and send it on to the Coastal Commission. While I appreciate the staff's interest in finding a compromise, this plan is not it. City Council needs to re-examine the law more carefully and accurately document real problems, and devise a more carefully considered law that does not violate broader coastal access and, frankly, the welfare of the most vulnerable. This is the speech I gave yesterday at the Coastal Commission, Protect the Poor and Public Access for All. And the article in the Santa Cruz Indie Media, indiebay.org, which you can find, does talk about what happened actually at the council meeting in some detail. And it runs, it sort of runs down, goes over a lot of the area that I've already gone over. There were a couple of dramatic moments, like Rochelle Noroyan, the council member who gave us this law, was very upset that the Coastal Commission was, you know, really going severely against her and completely unexpected, as I said. So she started arguing with the Coastal Commission from her seat. Now, I actually didn't really mind her doing this for a couple of reasons, some of them more cynical than others, but it's also a matter of principle. I think the public should have the right to interject its feelings in these meetings. And now, you know, there is a problem because people have a limited amount of time. You know, there was a very packed schedule for the Coastal Commission and so forth. But I don't think that, you know, she needed to be evicted from the room, just as I don't think people need to be evicted from city council chambers. But I do note, and I suspect that this is true, that, well, I don't suspect that, I know it's true, that Noroyan never objected when I was evicted from council chambers where she has power. She didn't evict me, but she sat quiet while it happened. And also where other people like activist Keith McHenry were evicted for speaking out or warned or intimidated for speaking out. But she expects herself to be able to speak out, she should. But she shouldn't be doing this to other people. She shouldn't expect a special double standard that allows her to do this. Of course, people in power always have a double standard. Let's put it this way. It's very unusual to find, I think, people in power who don't succumb to this temptation of privilege to have this double standard. She also reportedly said that this is what the Sentinel reported, which means it's dubious, and I'd have to hear it from some other witnesses to really be clearly and absolutely persuaded. She said that the city is being overrun with homeless people. You know, she's going to get away with saying we're being overrun by the niggers or the spics or the kikes. That wouldn't do at all. But, you know, it's okay to treat homeless people as subhuman, as some sort of pest to be eliminated, sprayed away, you know. And that is something that we have to fight, and it just does not go. And, you know, there's some people talk about education and better police training and, sensitivity training and blah, 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 blah. And that's fine. I got nothing against those things. But in the meantime, you remove these bigots from power and you advise them, you know, that you don't want them to be in charge of the levers of human rights guarantees or restoration or the ability to interfere with that process. And that's what we have currently. We have a coalition of bigots on the city council, or people who are amenable to bigotry, who see nothing really wrong with it, who don't mind giving it a pass. And actually, if provided it's wrapped up in a public safety issue, as Adolf Hitler did when in his election campaigns, and a lot of politicians do today and at different points, Republicans, it's a standard, and the Democrats, Clinton used it in the 90s, Bill Clinton, and ably supported by Hillary Clinton, you know, the super predators, that sort of thing, that justify the Crime Act of 1996. I think it was 96. Anyway, Rochelle was removed from the chambers, or let's put it this way, she was directed to leave the chambers, and she did, shouting as she went. And, you know, some people say, oh, you know, unbalanced, violating the rules. I say, no, she has a right to speak out, and I'm glad she does in her own way. And I also am glad she's getting her ass kicked, frankly, because there's a double standard that she uses. And not because it's good that people get thrown out of these meetings. Anyway, that was one small thing that happened. And you'll find me writing about this if you want to do more. Go to Santa Cruz Indie Media if you want to look for the longer story. It's pretty much, I've kind of given you the details, and I've already said I think we should dump the staff, both the staff of the Coastal Commission, which I don't think we have much power over, and the staff of the City Council, which the city manager has the power to hire and fire, though I have to look at the contracts of these people. But we have this, ridiculous city council election coming up, which we're going to have people mouthing the usual things about affordable housing and public safety and social services, but they're not going to talk about the real power structure of the town and firing the city attorney, firing the city manager, doing this the kind of things that would make real change, and actually even changing the whole structure of the city, which I don't have a lot of, you know, clear blueprints on, but I think that could be devised if you want to actually have the interests of everyone represented. And particularly, of course, I'm concerned with the interests of those represented who've not been represented, who have essentially been shat upon over the last, well, I don't know how many decades. So let's get back. That's me. That's the Coastal Commission thing. And also, I'm going to be playing stuff from the Coastal Commission, I believe, on Sunday. So you're actually going to hear the Coastal Commission's speeches, their questions to the floundering and flailing Scott Collins, which is kind of satisfying. I mean, Scott is such a smooth character in his business suit that it, and he's also pushing such a whole bullshit agenda, and he expects that it'll all be sort of swallowed whole, or maybe he didn't. I mean, maybe I'll ask him that the next time I see him, because he and I do talk. I don't know how much. Well, I don't think he's going to ever come on the radio, but you never can tell. But I think he, in essence, lied. And I think the entire city council staff lied about this. And the Coastal Commission transmitted those lies, swallowed them, to the Coastal Commission. When the Coastal Commission, however, realized that there was no documentation for any of this and that it had a severe impact on homeless people, they said, wait, 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 wait. This is not... It has to be considered more seriously. It has to be considered in detail, and it has to be considered with an understanding that you've got to have these accommodations before you take away access to the coast for the poor. And it may be that they were using this as a pretext to buy some time for poor people, to represent their interests in a broader way, which some complained about. If you look at the Sentinel website, that, you know, this none of the business of the Coastal Commission to, you know, engage in supporting poor people in terms of their broader rights. So they just, their only question is whether there's access to the coast and coastal environment is protected. So that's also a possibility. But other things are happening than that, or have been happening, and I'm going to get back to them just as soon as we hear a little more music. And that's what I'm going to look for now, a little something that makes me... Well, here's a good one. Let's see if this one is...
When I was just a little thing, I used to love parades with banners, bands, red balloons, and maybe lemonade. When I came home one May Day, my neighbor's father said, "Them marchers is all commies. Tell me, kid, are you a red?" Well, I didn't know just what he meant. My hair back then was brown. Our house was plain red brick like most others in the town. So I went and asked my mama why our neighbor called me red. My mommy took me on her knee and this is what she said. "Well, you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. If you march or agitate us, if you found a red." So you might as well ignore it or love the word instead, 'cause you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red. When I was growing up, had my troubles, I suppose, when someone took exception to my face or to my clothes, or tried to cheat me on a job or hit me on the head. When I organized a fight back, why the stinkers called me red. But you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. If you marched or agitated, then you're bound to hear it said. So you might as well ignore it or lost words instead, 'cause you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red. When I was living on my own apartment that I had a lousy, rotten landlord, let me tell you, he was bad. But when he tried to throw me out, I rubbed my hands and said, "You haven't seen a struggle if you haven't fought a red. And you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. If you march or agitate, then you're bound to hear it said. So you might as well ignore it or love the words instead, 'cause you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red." Well, I kept on agitating, 'cause what else can you do? You're gonna let the sons of bitches walk all over you. My friend said, "You'll get fired hanging with that commie mob. I should be so lucky, buddy, I ain't got a job." And you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. If you march or agitated, then you're bound to hear it said. So you might as well ignore it or love the words instead, 'cause you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red. Well, I've been agitating now for 50 years and more, for jobs and for equality and always against war. I'll keep on agitating as far as I can see, and if that's what being red is, well, it's good enough for me. 'Cause you ain't done nothing if you ain't been called a red. If you march or agitate, then you're bound to hear it said. So you might as well ignore it or love the words instead, 'cause you ain't been doing nothing if you ain't been called a red.
I'm not sure who sings that. It's Well, it says Faith Petrick and Mark Ross. I guess maybe they're the singers. Again, this is another YouTube special. It's from the Rebel Voices, Songs of the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, the Wobblies, and it's even got the lyrics here in case you want to learn the lyrics. Well, we just heard the lyrics, so we don't need to hear the lyrics. So, let's hear some original stuff from the streets. And maybe your phone calls, you never can tell. 427-3772 is the call-in number here.
Here at the, but there ought to be thousands.
Yeah. Hiroshima Day rally. Here, faithfully with a sign, is our old man, our old friend, fellow old guy, Uncle Paul here. Revolution Now sign.
Yeah.
And a number of the old activists. You see, we have the, we have some musical activity. Some folks are sitting in chairs. And I'm counting, 80 or 90 people. Curtis with us. Tallest ever sign. Hey. What do you got there? Your painting?
My painting.
All right.
So I thought Bill would be here.
He is. Right there.
Oh, is he?
Yes. It's the Raging Grannies. Not raging at the moment, but singing The Answer is Blowing in the Wind, as you can hear. No more nukes. Israel did 9/11. It's a Pat Kittles sign. Very few folks standing along the side of the freeway or the roadway holding up signs. No more war. Spirit of Hiroshima. Nagasaki never forget. Memory of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Fukushima, Chernobyl, and whatever the next one will be. And a large Food Not Bombs banner arrayed across the street. The United Nations Association, of which Steve Plaich is, I wouldn't say a charter member, but certainly an active member. All right.
Smiles. Brown. Looking. Flowering.
Steve, as usual, is taking pictures. He often documents these events, particularly the Freedom Sleepers event. And there's at least one city council candidate here, Steve Plaich. Could be others because I don't know what they all look like. Folks are assembling together. There's a Food Not Bombs water and perhaps lemonade stand, pocketing Food Not Bombs t-shirts. Now getting a few honks. That's good. Even have a little black face or two in the crowd. That's hey, Isaac Collins. Hey, man. Brian.
And I guess that's more of a sort of nostalgia session, or a bunch of local activists get together. I don't know what kind of direct action people could do in terms of nuclear weapons. I guess there was a Lockheed facility around here decades ago. I think there probably still is. I guess a march to the federal government demanding that Obama stop bullshitting with his Hiroshima visits and so forth. Here's an article, How U.S. Hiroshima Mythology Insults Veterans, by John LaForge. A lot of this is not particularly new to me and probably not to you. If you're a lefty or a regular listener to the show, Hiroshima Day comes every year. That's the day that the U.S. Incinerated an entire civilian population in Japan at the end of World War II. And here's what he writes. John LaForge writes, "The atomic bomb had nothing to do with the end of the war at all, according to Major General Curtis LeMay, World War II Air Force commander of the the 21st Bomber Command, September 20th, 1945. Hiroshima was on August 6th, 1945. And LeMay was a very right-wing guy, at least later in his life he was. He was the model, if you've seen Dr. Strangelove, for Colonel Jack Ripper. Actually, it was General Jack Ripper. It's a good movie. Check it out, Dr. Strangelove. I'm sure many of you have seen it. With President Obama's May 27th visit to Hiroshima, reporters, columnists, and editors generally adhered to the official story that the atomic bomb ultimately spared more Japanese civilians from a final invasion, as Kaiman Yan Terry wrote for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, or that without it, more Japanese would have died in a U.S. assault on the islands, as would have tens of thousands of Americans, as Mike Hashimoto wrote for the Dallas Morning News. The dropping of the bomb stopped the war, saved millions of lives, Harry Truman, former president, wrote in his memoir, Truman Speaks. Oddly, historians have found no record of any memo, cable, command projection, or study, military or civilian, where this estimate was suggested to him, millions of lives. In his book, The Invasion of Japan, historian John Ray Skates says, prophecies of extremely high casualties only came to be widely accepted after the war to rationalize the use of the atomic bombs. And historian Martin J. Sherwin has cited a considerable body of new evidence that suggests that the bomb may have cost rather than saved American lives. That is, if the U.S. had not been so determined to complete, test, and finally use the bomb, it might have arranged the Japanese surrender weeks earlier, preventing much bloodshed on Okinawa. Obama, uttering not a word about the historical controversy roiling since 1945, perpetuated the rationalization, cover-up, and nostalgia that guarantees the U.S. will never apologize for the needless and experimental massacre of 200,000 Japanese civilians, if you add to both Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the other Japanese city that was destroyed 3 days later. As Hashimoto wrote, no apology is needed for sparing lives on both sides. At least that's Obama's rationale. The New York Times reported vaguely that many historians believe the bombings on Hiroshima and then Nagasaki, which together took the lives of more than 200,000 people, saved lives on balance, since an invasion of the islands would have led to far greater bloodshed. While, quote, many historians may still believe this, the majority do not. As noted by the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission's chief historian, J. Samuel Walker, the consensus among scholars is that the bomb was not needed to avoid an invasion of Japan and to end the war within a relatively short time. It is clear that alternatives to the bomb existed and that Truman and his advisors knew it, Walker wrote in the winter 1990 issue of Diplomatic History. 5 years earlier, historian Gar Alpowitz wrote in Atomic Diplomacy, presently available evidence shows that the atomic bomb was not needed to end the war or save lives, and this was understood by American leaders at the time. Further declassification made his lengthy history, the decision to use the atomic bomb and the architecture of an American myth from 20 years ago in 1995, even stronger on this point. Attorneys and generals debunked the myth. Contrary to Governor Sarah Palin's claim that Obama's visit to Hiroshima insults veterans, the fiction that the atomic bombs ended the war is the real insult to the people who actually fought and won the war against Japan. The official myth that incinerating Hiroshima and Nagasaki forced Japan's surrender ignores and obscures the fact that combat veterans and bomber crews defeated Japan well before August 6, 1945, when Hiroshima happened. by sacrificing so mightily in dangerous bombing raids and in bloody battles for Midway, Guadalcanal, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and elsewhere. Dozens of high-level military officers have testified to this fact. Most of the ranking officers who directed the war in the Pacific have never agreed that the atom bombs were conclusive. Major General Curtis LeMay, commander of the 21st Bomber Command, quoted before, speaking publicly and for the record September 20th, 1945, said unequivocally, "The war would have been over in 2 weeks without the Russians entering and without the atomic bomb." Pressed by a reporter who asked, "Had they not surrendered because of the atomic bomb?" General LeMay, who directed the destruction of 67 major Japanese cities using mass incendiary attacks, said flatly, "The atomic bomb had nothing to do with the end of the war at all." And actually, the Soviet Union, or what's now called Russia, entered the war about the same time that they bombed Nagasaki, 3 days later on August 9th. I think it was August 8th, actually, that the Soviet Union entered the war. Likewise, General George Kenney, who commanded parts of the Army Air Forces in the Pacific, when asked in 1969 whether it was wise to use the atom bomb, said, "No, I think we had the Japs licked anyhow. I think they would have quit probably within a week or so of when they did quit," Alperitz recounts in his book, The Decision. Alperitz's research found that Admiral Louis Strauss, special assistant to World War II Navy Secretary James Forrestal, wrote to the naval historian Robert Albion December 19, 1960, from the Navy's point of view, there are statements by Admiral King, Admiral Halsey, Admiral Radford, Admiral Nimitz, and others who expressed themselves to the effect that neither the atomic bomb nor the proposed invasion of the Japanese mainland were necessary to produce the surrender. In Mandate for Change, General Dwight Eisenhower wrote that when Secretary of War Henry Stimson told him atom bombs are going to be used, quote, "I voiced to him my grave misgivings, first on the basis of my belief that Japan was already defeated and that dropping the bomb was completely unnecessary." President Truman's chief of staff, Admiral William Leahy, adamantly agreed, as Robert Lifton and Greg Mitchell report in Hiroshima and America, 50 Years of Denial. Leahy said, "It is my opinion that the use of this barbarous weapon at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material assistance in our war against Japan. The Japanese were already defeated and ready to surrender because of the effective sea blockade and the successful bombing with conventional weapons." Lifton and Mitchell also said that Henry Hap Arnold, commanding general of the Army Air Forces, said in his memoir, "It always appeared to us that atomic bomb or no atomic bomb, the Japanese were on the verge of collapse." Answers to questions about the need of the atomic bombings were given early on, but some were kept secret. The U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey published its conclusion that Japan would likely have surrendered in 1945 without atomic bombing, without a Soviet declaration of war, and without an American invasion. Alperowitz reports in The Decision. The historian spent 30 years studying the issue and has revealed that a 1946 study by the intelligence group of the War Department's Military Intelligence Division, discovered in 1989, concluded that the atomic bomb had not been needed to end the war, and judged it was almost a certainty the Japanese would have capitulated upon the entry of Russia into the war. The government's official pretexts for incinerating Hiroshima and Nagasaki still dominate public opinion. In 2005, a Gallup poll reported that 57% of people surveyed in the U.S. believed the bombings were justified and legitimate. The myth retains its usefulness. President Obama's proposed 30-year, trillion-dollar program to rebuild the nuclear weapons production establishment can only go ahead if taxpayers hold fast to the idea that something good can come from the mass destruction of civilians. And that's the story from Counterpunch website, How U.S. Hiroshima Mythology Insults Veterans. And I guess one of these days I'm going to have to really closely go over those who are defending the atomic bomb in order to see if I can find any shreds of justification that perhaps leftist historians are ignoring. So you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert, and this is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. The silent phone can ring if you give it a call at 427-3772. I want to thank the various people who have contacted me by email or by phone, thanking me for doing the appeal to the Coastal Commission. It was surprising, you know, what happened. And I don't think it, certainly, you know, it's encouraging in a certain way, but the real work remains to be done. And perhaps we'll be talking about that in future shows, or I've actually already gotten some suggestions from Peggy Lee Kennedy down in Southern California about what we're going to have to do. She's anticipating that there will be a hearing before the Coastal Commission, a so-called de novo hearing, where the Coastal Commission will consider the law in more detail and more carefully. But again, my conversation with Scott Collins yesterday had him suggesting that this is likely, the city is not likely to proceed with the law, considering the kick in the chops it got from the Coastal Commission, in essence underpinning, or I'd say undercutting, the entire rationale that they're using. I mean, they can't really, I don't think they can find the statistics to justify this kind of a law. It would only work if people let it slide through. And because this Coastal Commission had no particular fear of being criticized by the bigots on the west side, or by Take Back Santa Cruz, they could look at these figures somewhat more objectively and also somewhat more compassionately, I think you have to say. And again, as I said, I'll be going into this in more detail on Sunday when I come back. I have a long show on Sunday for those who don't know. And let's hear a little music now for, I don't know, I like music. I like some of these. These songs are lots of fun, or at least more fun than hearing myself talk all the time, although I must admit I'm... Let's see here. We got some kind of a song here. We don't want that one, I don't think. Let's proceed to the next one. I don't think we want that one either. Let's see here. Looking for something and not quite finding it. Let's see what we got here.
You hear the people singing the song of angry men. It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drums, there is a life about to start when tomorrow comes. Will you join in a crusade? Who will be strong and stand with me? Beyond the barricade, is there a world you long to see? Then join in the fight that will give you the right to be free. Do you hear the people singing the songs of angry men? It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the beating of your heart echoes the beating of the drum, there is a light about to start when tomorrow comes.
Will you give all you can give so that a banner may advance? Some will fall and some will lift. Will you stand up and take your chance? The blood of the martyrs will water the meadows of France.
Do you hear the
case you don't recognize it, was from Les Mis, Do You Hear the People Sing? Back to the streets now.
So, I'm talking with that Bound for Arizona man.
I'm Alex Rudd.
Alex, you're sitting here with your portfolio, which is a series of paintings.
Paintings and mixed media, some digital work as well.
And you are illegally outside the blue boxes, as well as illegally sitting on the berm of a planter. Is there any other laws you're considering breaking?
No, but I think that in itself is a pretty ridiculous law.
Oh, yeah.
I might be breaking other laws, not to my knowledge, though.
You could sit next to a building. That would violate the law.
Yeah. That might stir some ruckus.
So have you had any kind of contact with people who've been cautioning you about your questionable behavior?
Yeah, actually, one security guard, he was pretty nice about it. He told me to move into the box, but I think that's pretty dumb rule if you ask me, but he was pretty nice about it, so I'll give him that.
He nicely asked you to get inside the cage and stay there.
Yeah, exactly.
Except for only for an hour, though.
Only for an hour.
So is this your first experience of the Santa Cruz laws?
Yes, it is. I've only been here for 24 hours, so.
Well, I'm glad to hear you haven't been ticketed or arrested.
No.
How long have you been out here?
On the West Coast?
No, sitting where you're sitting.
Oh, I actually just posted up about 15 minutes ago.
So you're,
So I haven't been messed with yet, but we'll see.
Well, we can always hope.
We can always hope.
And your name is?
Alex Rudd, and I'm going to keep on doing my thing.
Alex, how long do you intend to be generally outside the box?
Generally for another 2 or 3 hours.
And what about in town?
In town? Probably leaving tomorrow.
You're on your way.
On my way out, yeah. I'm hoping I don't get messed with by the law.
First experience in Santa Cruz?
Yes, it is. Loving it so far. A lot of tourists, though.
Well, glad to have you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
What was your name?
I'm Robert.
Robert?
Yeah,
nice to meet you.
I'll take your hand as soon as I finish dealing with
it.
Unusual sight, Tamarack inside the rare blue box next to the building, which is the couple of performers outside the blue box, but not with any really manifest display device. Kevin the Type is setting up in his usual spot near the Pacific Trading Company. And Sean Alkini with a series of displays mostly inside the blue box, almost entirely. Any blue box blues?
What?
Hassles for being inside the blue box too long? Or?
Not really. I had a ranger say something to me once, but he wasn't, like, super insistent on it. He said that, like, I'm guessing somebody complained about what I was saying. Not what I was saying, but where I was.
At this spot here or some other spot?
It's over...
You're pointing down the street.
Yeah, that over on the other side of the street. He said that basically that they're not great for me. I don't know what it is for anybody else, but he just said to me, one ranger for you. I don't know who it was. I might be able to point him out. But and he said that just as long as, like, I move. He didn't really put much emphasis on it being, you know, 100 feet and you can't be there in 24 hours and all this other stuff. He just says as long as I move squares. And he didn't even say, like, the hour thing was a real...
How long ago? Today? Yesterday?
It was like last week, yeah.
And you've been out here pretty regularly or not?
For a couple weeks, yeah.
I see you're also working on a piece of artwork, many of which you have posted on this sort of window display. I don't know, how would you describe this display device here?
It's just a grid, iron grid. You can get it from any festival supplies, basically what they use to hang things on, and canopy tent kind of festival displays for retail. So.
And no police art critic has come up and said, excuse me, sir, you're creating a work of art that is unfinished. That's a violation of mint.
Nobody seemed to care about that. Police don't really care about, to me, have not said anything to me, really, about anything. You know, rangers have, though. So it seems to be the Rangers are more, that's more their job than it is the police, is to keep an eye out for that kind of stuff. They, like I said, the only time he said is that I need to move, but after that I haven't been approached at all, you know. And I try to move at least once per day, but I don't, I'm not moving every hour. Some people are, but it also has to be a place to move to. Like I said, I asked him about, well, what about 100 feet? And he was like, well, just move to another square. You know, so he wasn't too concerned about the 100 feet rule, you know.
So really, it's kind of a crapshoot who you talk to.
Probably. I would imagine that's how it is.
And do you mind if I play this on free radio?
No, go ahead.
And we've been talking with
Sean Blake, a.k.a. Sean Alchemy.
And Senor Alchemy, how do we find your work? Is there another place to...
You can find it at Sean Alchemy, S-H-A-W-N-A-L-C-H-E-M-I, all over the internet. Just Facebook, Twitter, all that good stuff.
Everywhere.
Facebook, Twitter, Instagram is at Sean Alchemy. And SeanAlchemy.com.
Thank you, Sean Alchemy.
Thank you.
And that was kind of on Blue Box Patrol. This was August 7th when I was wandering around getting these interviews. It's interesting that, again, it looks like the police and the Rangers, with the host gone now, the so-called Hostile Fatality Squad, as I call them, the Yellow Jackets, no longer there. There's still first alarm security guards around. But the idea is, how far can you intimidate the public? You got to be careful, because if people really begin to ignore you, then you better not push it, or you'll be revealed to be, you either have to come down hard, which may produce a very serious response, or you have to be exposed as being as what some would call a paper tiger. And so, you know, I mean, I'm not sure why there hasn't been much more severe enforcement of these ordinances. I'm glad that there hasn't been. But, I mean, they are singling out people. Alex Skelton and Geoff Jones go to trial on August 30th at 1:30 in Department 10, for those who want to follow that case. And they are citing some people. James, who's a handicraft vendor, jewelry, crystals, he's gotten a $300 ticket. And there are others who've gotten citations too, which I've talked about. But it seems to be pretty random and arbitrary and dependent on the mood of the cop, which is, of course, you know, the definition of the police state. If the cops are in a good mood, everything's rosy. If they're not, good luck, because the law isn't really relevant, although the law here is so extreme it allows cops to do, you know, it makes it seem like they're being sweet and gentle if they don't enforce the law, which, of course, they shouldn't be, because the law is unconstitutional, violates the right to use the public spaces, engage in innocent behavior, engage in First Amendment activity, and so forth. Let us hear some more.
You're welcome.
Yes.
So I'm here on the street speaking with a person in a homeless garden project outfit, but I think you're speaking for yourself rather than for the garden project. Or maybe you're speaking for both.
Both. I am speaking for both.
You are Maddie. That's what your sign is.
I am Maddie.
Previously of the coffee roasting company.
Oh, long, 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 long time ago. But yes, previously of a coffee roasting company.
Right.
And I'm well aware of the problem that homeless people have in Santa Cruz. And they should be able to have a place to be and go. And if they have a car or an RV, they should be entitled to use that as a home. And why can't they? Is the question. Why?
We don't like their kind around here.
Yeah, well, you know what? Isn't this America? Last I checked.
If you have the money, you can give.
Well, how many people have money? I mean, no one can afford to barely live here. The rents are off the charts, you know, and an RV has a shower in it. A lot of them do. They can shower, they have a kitchen, whatever, and they're taken care of. It keeps them off the street, which nobody, everybody has a complaint about that, you know, and then they have a home, and now they can't use that. So what are they supposed to do, for Christ's sakes? What are they supposed to do?
Move to Modesto.
Yeah, well, I lived in Modesto. Have you?
No.
Let me tell you, it's a dust bowl armpit, hotter than the hubs of hell. I was out of there in 20 minutes.
The poor should be grateful.
For?
Any place to rest their weary heads.
Yeah, but they're not allowed for very long. They're asked to move on.
Well, it helps them maintain their energy to keep going.
Can I swear?
Yes.
Okay, that is bullshit.
Fucking bullshit?
Oh, fucking bullshit.
And this is a conversation that happened before the Coastal Commission essentially threw out or said, we aren't going to give you a permit for your RV law until we look at it a lot more closely. But that does not end the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz, which includes falling asleep between the hours of 11 and 8:30 in the morning anywhere, whether you're at least on any public property, even in your own van or your own RV or your own car, if it's legally parked, even if it's legally registered. That remains the reality here. It's the reason why Freedom Sleep Out 58 is coming around the corner next Tuesday at City Council. And it's the reason why, in a way, though I appreciated all the thanks that people gave me for filing this lawsuit against the RVs, it's really not a huge victory to actually, you know, have this thing overturned or kept back, because the police still have this fundamental law that criminalizes poor people, and they are using it. Well, we'll hear some more in a moment. Here's an email from Andy Carcello. Your operation ruined me, from Dominican Hospital. So once again, Dominican Hospital ruins another life with an incompetent surgeon, and the life that it ruins is mine. Let's see. The first reconstructive surgery I had here, I came out of the anesthesia while they were mounting the plates in my leg. My mother's heart surgery is botched by Fishman and Singh, and now you screw my heart surgery after assuring me that everything will come out fine. Dominican Hospital ruins lives. I should have never trusted any of your incompetent, bumbling doctors. Singh and Johnson are idiots that hurt people in order to stuff money in their pockets. Never go to Dominican Hospital. It is a meatpacking plant for those mistaken enough to wander in here onto their kill floor. And Andy, you may remember, is this fellow who was evicted from the homeless lack of services centers, Paul Lee Loft, got pneumonia on the streets, and then had to rush to heart surgery about a week ago. Now, it's really hard to judge whether what the hell he's talking about in terms of any specific things that went wrong, but he obviously is not happy. I also have been contacted by Pat and John Colby, who are very concerned about Freedom Sleeper activist Lucero Luna, who has been on the show a little bit. She's a Spanish-speaking, very colorfully attired woman who has been demonstrating downtown against the downtown ordinances by sitting on the sidewalk, by essentially making a ruckus and demanding the police arrest her. A ruckus meaning she isn't hurting anyone, she isn't assaulting anyone, but she is ostentatiously violating the absurd downtown ordinances. And she's been jailed, I would guess now, about half a dozen times for, you know, sitting on the sidewalk next to a building, which at one point she was held on $5,000 bail. I checked the jail and found that out myself, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 days ago. But the Colbys, who are activists concerned with bringing these issues to the attention of different federal agencies, a strategy I'm not too excited about, or at least there's nothing wrong with it, except it's if you list 45 different agencies every time you send out a missive, you begin to look like you're, in any case, they're concerned about Lucero Luna and her health. They pointed out that at the last time she was jailed, they woke her up every hour, every half hour. They shined a flashlight on her. I don't know whether it was a suicide watch or an act of harassment, but that's something that has been complained about by activists fighting solitary confinement in the prisons in this state. So I just wanted to kind of mention it. I don't have any more info about Lucero. I tried to interview her recently, and she didn't stop to talk, so I can't really say what she's up to. But if I hear more, I will talk more about it. In the meantime, you get to hear this.
Between you and me and the fucking bullshit.
Homeless Garden Project gifts.
And you can grow me.
Well, you're actually speaking freely, and you will be on Thursday evening. So there you are. How is the Homeless Garden Project doing? Has it taken a stand against this?
I don't know. I don't know about that. You could go in there and ask them, because I'm sure they would be very supportive. They're doing really well. Can I tell you, they've made a great stand with helping homeless people find jobs, right, and get homes. They have provided a farm where they can grow vegetables, flowers, fruit that they sell. It gives them a trade, right, and there's a place for them to park out there because a lot of them have RVs. Now, I don't know if they get booted out of there or not.
It will be illegal after early September to park anywhere in Santa Cruz after
10
midnight.
After midnight.
And that's no longer true. It will be still. It'll remain legal. However, you will not be able to sleep in your vehicle, as has been the case since 1978, and will continue to be the case, and continue to be ignored, I would assume, by the majority of people who have vehicles. People just often just don't answer the knock on the door of the vehicle, and as a consequence of the neighborhood anxiety about people in their vehicles, we have people like Lieutenant Habey, former police officer, I think he's still a reserve officer, pounding on people's vehicles and doing so recently. I got a report of Joe Habey doing this recently. He was the subject of a song back in 1996 when he would harass the homeless sleepers protest at City Hall. We had a protest back then as well. The famous Maybe Habey song, Maybe Habey, you'll be fair. Maybe Habey, you will care. Maybe Habey, we will dare someday. Oh, you are the one who steals our bags and you... And it goes on and on. It's quite a song. It's, it's not really that much of a song. But it is, goes local, which is what I like.
Midnight to 5.
Okay, so they can sleep during the day and then drive around at night.
If they wake up by 11 o'clock at night, after which it will be illegal to sleep at night.
Exactly. They're going to have to work the graveyard shifts.
It's a grave situation.
It is a grave situation, and it's very unfair, is what it is.
Now, are you yourself outside?
No, I'm not. I actually am living, I'm a live-in caregiver. Is what I am, and I'm lucky.
In-home care services?
Yes.
Support service?
Yes. And so I'm living with somebody right now. But let me tell you, if I didn't have that job, I'd be on the street. I would be on the street.
Now, before you had that job, were you on the street, or were you...
I haven't yet, and it came close. I was homeless for a short period of time this year, but I was lucky that I have a lot of friends that offered me a spot until something broke for me, which finally did. But for about 3 months, I was couch surfing. Because it's unaffordable. It's completely unaffordable for a person like me, a law-abiding, tax-paying citizen. I don't cause trouble. I'm not drinking and taking drugs, and police aren't chasing me. And homeless, I was.
So is the Homeless Garden Project only provides food to sell to middle-class people who have the money to buy it, right?
Yes, but it's affordable. It is totally affordable.
Not for homeless people.
I don't know what the situation is, and I feel really bad that I can't speak better about that.
It's not a collective garden where homeless people can grow food and then eat it.
I think they can.
Really?
To be perfectly honest with you.
That's new to me.
Because they are working there. They're working there. I can't imagine they would tell them you can't have any.
But you don't really know for sure one way or the other.
I don't.
I don't either.
I can't imagine.
Well, my understanding for the last 25 years is that they have, and again, it's based kind of on
second-hand information that the food is not grown for homeless people there. It is grown for them to sell, or the people who manage the place to sell to other people.
God, if that's the case, I'm sorry. There's got to be a reason for that. And I don't know. I mean, God, that's terrible.
Well,
that's,
you might find out because I'd be curious.
Yes.
Now.
I'll give you my card. I should go down there. I did the other day and picked strawberries and bought myself some flowers. And I had a huge bunch of flowers, which was a fraction of the price that they sell them for at the farmer's market. And don't get me wrong, the farmer's market is a great thing. And now they take food stamps.
But you did have to pay for them.
Yeah,
you weren't allowed to pick them or anything of that kind.
No.
No. You know, I mean, you might be able to find out from your fellow workers.
I know him. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. I'm glad you're able. You got the energy to make contact with these people. I don't seem to be that energetic.
See, that to me is painfully sad. Painfully sad. He needs to be medicated.
Medication isn't always the best way, but you mean he needs to get some kind of care, is what you mean?
Yes, he does. Some kind of help.
You good. Take care, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But
I feel
I'll give you my card. I want a full report from you, Maddie.
Okay.
On everything that goes on out there, plus everything that goes on the street, plus
do
whatever
else. Do the best
else.
I can for you.
Okay, now, you remember me from your old coffee roasting day?
Yes, I've known you forever, and you drive around that car with stickers all over it.
That is true. Now, do you remember any experiences we had there at the roasting company? Positive or negative?
I think they were positive. Do you remember me?
Not really.
20 years, pal. 20 years. You weren't gray, and neither was I.
You aren't gray.
I'm blonde now because it's easier to cover my roots.
You dyed your hair?
Yeah, that's something.
Well, if you want a hug, you let me know, okay? Get over here, big girl.
Big girl, am I? I am, huh?
Unusually or unpractically large.
Good.
Yeah. This is the...
And we leave this touching, hugging scene, and we're also going to be leaving the studio shortly, because that's about it for this edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Again, I will be hoping to play some of the relatively, well, certainly encouraging and sometimes eloquent comments by Coastal Commission members, although they don't have much in the way of power. They do have some power in the coastal zone, and that, although it's kind of a... I would say sneaky way of dealing with these issues. It's a way of subverting power by using their own rules and regulations, even though it seems kind of, I'm not sure what the word is, secondary, off to the side. It's like using a legal technicality. But if you're fighting... If you're fighting the beast of bigotry, you do what you can. And people who live in their vehicles are really at the survival waterline, really. I mean, the next step is to lose your vehicle, which many do because they can't afford the tickets that they're getting. Some of them legitimate, some of them not. So I will be coming back with those comments from the Coastal Commission. And I may play the whole hearing, the part of it that concerns the RVs, although it gets a little technical, so it may not be the most exciting thing. But let's see if there's anything else I wanted to bring up. I think... there may not be much...